See, a big difference between us also is that you like children.
Just when I guessed you could not sink any lower, you're listening to the Rish Outcast. Well, you've kind of made your bed, haven't you?
Hello, folks. This is Rish Outfield, and oh boy, I don't know how to tell you this. You're listening to the Rish Outcast. Again. When you step on a rake and it hits you in the face, I guess it's funny the first time, but not the third or fourth time. I've got a special guest on the show today. A real special guest, not an imaginary one. I've got Abigail Hilton. She is a podcaster. She's a writer. She is a nurse anesthetist who can actually say that. And to me, that's the greatest success, when you can say nurse anesthetist in life.
Part of me wants to just hear you impersonate me instead of starting to talk.
Oh, but you don't have as strong a Southern accent as I would give you if I was impersonating you.
It's true. Yours would be funnier. Also, guys, I have stepped on this rake for, I don't know, like 5 years, 6 years, however long you've had your Patreon. I've been subscribed to it.
Well, okay, that's great. I mean, it's not great for you. It's great for me.
In spite of Rich's ruthless impersonation of me as a Devil Wears Prada kind of overproductive author, yes, I've been here. I was just telling him how delightful Lex Luthor versus Bran Sanderson is, and that I hope this segment returns.
Well, you say something about being super productive, and it's like opening the door. It's like when you were a child and they'd say, don't talk about such things because the devil's listening. And when you mention him, he'll come right in. He'll find a crack under the door. He'll find a crack in your... No, I don't think they would have said that. But yeah, let's not bring up Brandon Sanderson, or I am liable to go on a rant.
Lex Luthor might show up.
And we can't have that. I mean, he's done so much for the world, Brandon Sanderson. I have an aunt who would not be alive. That train derailed, and if it weren't for Brandon... So, yes, I do bring you up a lot, and I wonder, it's not one of the questions that I prepared, but I wonder if that is annoying to you, if that is flattering to you, if it is a little bit of both, or a third thing that I haven't thought of.
I don't know, a little bit of both. I'm always, I always perk up, and you're like, oh, he's going to talk about me. but sometimes, like, oh, I'm not that mean, but maybe I am, and I don't know it. But yeah, you also overcharacterize, like you are constantly writing and you talk about it all the time. And I'm like, I bet Rish doesn't realize that I came up with like 10 things to procrastinate today instead of writing. Like, part of my brain is like, I could make advertisements, or I could write a newsletter, or I could make Facebook ads, or watch a course, like anything other than write. You know, we all fight that battle, and you seem to win it most of the time. Like, You write a lot.
Well, this year, 2019, I've done a really good job, and I'm proud of myself, and that it feels weird. I'm not used to that. So I hope that there are people out there that listen to me say, I didn't want to write, but I forced myself to do it, and I'm really glad that I did. And maybe it encourages them, because as non-productive as I am, I used to be worse. And so hopefully people that could use that advice, that could use the encouragement or inspiration, take something positive out of that. And so often I talk about you, not like the great Brandon Sanderson, without whom this world would be on its own, really. We would need to take care of our own problems. But no, here he comes again. Oh, the global warming is a problem we brought upon ourselves, but we're not going to fix it ourselves. Sorry.
Well, I wasn't going to say this, but he did turn up in the operating room just the other day and do a brain surgery that no one else could do. So, I mean, it's pretty amazing. He delivered a baby in the hall on the way, and then he wrote a novel while sitting in the waiting room.
Yep, see, that's what's so great about him. Of course, that doctor that needed to perform the brain surgery won't know how to do it the next time. And sometimes you have to teach yourself how to do something instead of having some super human come along and do it for you.
That's true.
Sorry, I feel like I've already pounded that into the ground. But no, many times you have been an inspiration to me because you write a lot and you work a lot. Somehow you manage to balance those two things. And so that encourages me to work a little harder. If Abby can do it, I can do it. You had a Patreon before me. You had an audience that you engaged with. And that also inspired me to do, you know, the things that I do. And so most of the time when I invoke your name, it's not shaking my fist at the heavens, at that red cape. It's you know, because you're a positive influence in my life.
Thank you.
And so, I thought that I would sit down with you and talk about writing. And talk about your process and your opinions on a couple of things. So I'm just going to go ahead and ask, how do you write? I mean, is there a place that you go? Can you just write anywhere?
I travel a lot for a living, so I can't get too precious about a location. I would say I could write anywhere, but there's times when that's not true. I have a hard time writing on planes because I feel like my seatmate is reading over my shoulder. Every once in a while, I can sort of like drop into the right mental headspace on a public transportation sort of situation. But yeah, usually I just need a moderately comfortable chair and somewhere to prop up my computer. It really has more to do with where I am in the story than where I am like in reality, in real life. If I know what's going to happen next and I'm excited about writing it, I really can write that just about anywhere. And if I don't know what's going to happen next and I'm kind of stuck, it really doesn't matter how wonderful the circumstances are. I just have a hard time spitting it out. And getting stuck for me has a lot more to do with decision fatigue. Have you heard that term before?
I haven't.
So Kat Valente has a Patreon that she did a great essay on this. And I've heard other people talk about it before too. It's basically decisions are actually mentally draining for people. Every decision you have to make takes a little bit of effort, and it's a muscle you can build up, but you still only got so many decisions in you per day. So if I'm working in the operating room all day long and I'm making, you know, lots and lots of little decisions about how I'm going to do those cases, it's hard for me to come home, and then you sit down to write a novel and there's tons of decisions. You're making decisions constantly when you're writing a novel. And if I'm doing other big things, like this last year, I moved across the country, I bought a house, all cool life events, but all of them involved hundreds, thousands of tiny decisions. And so it was hard to then to sit down at the computer and a whole bunch of more decisions in the form of a novel. And I've heard other authors talk about this before, where if in real life they're making tons and tons and tons of decisions, it's hard to sit down at the computer and then keep making those decisions in story world. So that's a factor.
Isn't it different making decisions where the story should go, what the character says, where they go, what they do? In my real life, I am often powerless. But in writing, what I say goes. The decisions that I make actually have consequences that can be positive. I guess you have authority in your line of work, though. To me... there's something refreshing about the decisions of, you know, how does the girl take it? Does she laugh? Does she get angry? Because I'm actively influencing events, where in real life, nothing I say is going to fix anything.
Well, I'm sorry. For better or for worse, I often am in situations in real life where, yeah, I can make things better, make things very, very worse. Or put it another way, like if I make a small mistake, something large and terrible can happen. And so, and I'm probably putting too much weight on my job, but it does follow me home to a certain extent. I've spent most of my career working part-time so that I could write. And this last year and a half, I decided I was going to, I wanted to concentrate on my writing. I wanted to try to ramp that up to like a living wage but I decided that before I backed off of anesthesia, it was going to completely pay off its own debt, my student loan, and that it was going to buy me a house. Doggone it. And so I worked pretty much a full-time schedule for the last year and a half. So that was a lot of focus on that. And I've been doing it for 10 years. So it's not as hard as it was at the beginning, but still it's a stressful job. You know, you feel like you're doing something meaningful. So that is nice, but it is also, it's a high stakes job. You make a little mistake, something horrible could happen.
Okay, well then writing should be a step down for you. Making those decisions, suddenly it's all right. You know, the worst that could happen is I have to rewrite the chapter.
And that's true, but there's still just this brain fog that comes with doing that all day long. But the big thing, and this is something that we both share, like I don't have a family or children. Occasionally people will be like, how do you do all these things? And I'm like, this huge time sink that other people have, I do not have. So I do have a lot more time for other stuff. So that's a factor that can, I'm talking about things that can prevent me from writing, because mostly I write pretty steadily. I'm not usually much of a sprinter. I try to write 1,000 words a day. And if I'm really humming along, 3,000 words is usually my speed limit. I can write more than that, but the problem is I'm one of these people that cycles back through the last few days of stuff that they wrote before starting to write my words for the day. It helps me keep the pacing right. It helps me sink into the right headspace with the characters. You know, if I'm taking a long time to write a scene, you can have the situation where you write a scene over a month, but the scene happens in 30 minutes. And if I don't read back over the things that I previously wrote, it will start to feel like more time has passed than it should feel like. So anyway, I cycle back through the last couple of days. I edit and read back through the last couple of days of things that I wrote. And if I get to more than 3,000 words a day, I start to, you know, 6,000 words to edit before I can start writing. And if I get to more than that, I just run out of writing time at the time I finish editing my stuff. So between 1,000 and 3,000 words a day is usually what I clip along at when I don't have major life things going on and I'm working part-time instead of full-time. Sometimes other stuff that's going on in my life affects my writing. I don't know how much to say about that. I'll say this, I can cut this out of this too. Like, when my parents got a divorce, it certainly made it harder to write romance, right? Because when my friends got a divorce, that made it harder to write stories about people falling in love.
Well, so right now you're working full time. Are you like me in that when you're stuck somewhere, when you're at work, when you're in church, when you're in a waiting room, when you're in traffic, that's when you want to write the most. You long for it.
Yeah.
But then when I get free, I get home, I get out of whatever it is, then I lose the desire because there's a million other things that are easy to do.
Yeah, I do some of that. Or just, I do have a job that has some repetition to it. Anesthesia is very much, it's kind of like flying a plane. You take off and then you cruise for a while and then you land. And so during that maintenance phase, that middle phase, you know, there's times when there's not that much to do. And yeah, I will definitely come up with lots of ideas that I want to write. If I'm really in a good writing frame of mind, my characters will start talking in my head. My listeners have heard me say that plenty of times. Like, I'll be like, oh, it's going well. My characters are talking in my head. If I'm in the hospital for 11 hours and I come home, I'll be like, I want to write so much. And then I'm like falling asleep at the keyboard and I'm not getting anything done it's all done. I gave it all to the job. There's nothing left. But, I will definitely do that thing where I'm out and about and think of ideas and I write them down or, you know, the characters from a different story will start talking in my head and I'm like, no, that's not what we're doing right now. We're writing this other one, but they don't pay any attention.
You know, that kind of makes me think about what I do with the audio. How is it to hear your characters narrated by somebody else when they've been voices inside your head for so long?
It is loads of fun. I'm getting audio right now from Lauren for Incubus Yule, and it makes me want to write those characters again. When I get audio from you, it's always super exciting. It's usually really fun. I mean, every once in a while, something will come out in such a way that I'm like, I mean, you know me. I send you way too many retakes, probably more than anybody else. But I love it. It makes me excited about writing those characters again. And sometimes people will deliver a line in such a way that I didn't That's not really how I heard it in my head, but it's interesting.
We interpreted it differently than you had.
Yeah.
Well, do you ever miss the full cast versions of your work?
Every once in a while I do. Well, every once in a while I'll have a conversation with myself that goes like this. It's been a long time since I've done full cast. That was kind of fun. And then I'll think it's also been a long time since I stabbed myself in the eyeball. It's just so much work. Every time I think fondly of it, I'm like, you're only remembering the fun parts, Abby. Remind yourself of the carpal tunnel from hours and hours of audio editing and begging voice actors that dropped off the map and didn't respond and sending retakes to people that took 3 months to record one line and being worried that they were never going to get back to you. And like, oh my goodness, it's such a lot of work. But I still get reviews from people on Albatross that'll be like, well, this was fine, but it wasn't as good as the other one that was full cast. Disappointed that she didn't have a full cast do this production like the last one. Oh well, they wouldn't be willing to pay, you know, 10 times as much money, which is how much more time it takes.
Okay, yeah, that's a good point. You don't have control on Audible over what your thing costs, right?
You do not. I think they charge near the limit of what most people would be willing to pay. Although most people on Audible are buying with credits, which is quite different than what the list price, you know, looks like. Credits are like $12 to $14. So the list price is sort of illusory. I mean, there are people that do just shop with cash. But yeah, you don't have any control on Audible. You know, have you gotten involved with Findaway Voices at all?
No.
So they're Draft Digital's new Audible competitor, and they have a introduce authors to voice actors sort of thing on there. I don't know what you have to do to get into Findaway's pool of people, but they're probably the biggest Audible competitor for self-publishers out there right now, and they distribute to a whole bunch of different platforms. None of them are as big as Audible, but I've been told that all of them together can be competitive with Audible dollars. Obviously, if you're doing that, then you're going to be not exclusive with Audible, which means you're going to make 25% instead of 40%, and that's a big chunk to take out of the biggest audiobook retailer. But some people do say that they make it back on all the other platforms. And then, of course, they're not exclusive to Audible. You can set your own prices through Findaway. You can give stuff away for free, and that can be a big draw if you've got, like, a series starter that you're using as a loss leader. Most of my stuff is in 7-year contracts with Audible right now, although Cowrie Catchers will be coming out of contract in, I think it's 2021, which, think about that. That means it's been in there for 7 years. Until long ago we were working on that. But yeah, it'll be coming out of contract in a couple of years, and I probably will give it a trial on some of, you know, be not exclusive with Audible and try some of those others. I think in a couple more years those platforms will be even more mature and there'll be probably more listeners there. But that's the, if you want to try distribution that's wider than Audible and you have a few more choices, you know, try Findaway.
Do you think that that's one of those things where you regret not getting in early? Or is it fine to just sit and wait, and once it becomes big, then jumping in?
I don't know. There's pluses and minuses, right? So I would think that mostly the bugs will be worked out as more time passes. I mean, I guess the contracts could change and like your percent of royalties could get smaller. One of the reasons I wouldn't yank my stuff out of Audible, because technically you can get stuff out sooner than 7 years. If you write them an email and be quite annoying, they will let you go. But those early books that I put in there have got better contracts than what they offer now. Cowrie Catchers had the early contracts were 50%. And then there was an escalator for every like 1,000 books you sold, got a percent or two more. I can't remember exactly. But yeah, Cowrie Catchers gets like, I think it's 51% at this point. Whereas if I signed the new contract, I'm sure it would be for 40%, right? That's what all their contracts look like now. But they goofed at the beginning, or they realized, you know, 2 years in, they realized they could just give us less and there's nothing we could do about it. So that's what they did. But all of those old books that were signed with those first, you know, early contracts have a slightly better percentage royalty. So I wouldn't pull them out just for that reason. And so, yeah,
But wait, sorry. What happens after the 7 years? in 2021, do they renegotiate or does it suddenly become the 40% on cowrie catchers?
I'm sure they're not going to offer, why on earth would they offer me the original contract? I mean, they decided not to do that contract a long time ago. So yeah, the old contract I signed will run out and I will have to decide whether to renew. And I'm sure it would be renewing with their current contract. Yeah, there's still authors around that some of the romance authors, I think, ran all the way up that escalator. So some people out there are getting 90% royalties. They got in the door really early and then sold a lot of books. And those people are going to be out of contract like next year or the year after. And then they'll have to decide what to do with those books. There's not a lot of people, you know, because as you pointed out, we got in the door early. I'm sorry if this is boring. Are we boring people? I feel like when I start talking about like publisher stuff, there's a little bell that goes off my head saying you're being boring. Your audience doesn't care. But this is your audience. So if I'm being boring, please just stop me.
Well, yeah, I have no idea what they think. To me, it's interesting because you're on another tier than I am. And so I'm able to look and say, oh, that might be nice.
I am happy to introduce you to this tier and drag you up to another rung. I'm doing a mailing list push right now. So for years and years, I kind of intentionally kept my mailing list small because I realized that to really like nurture your mailing list, you need to send out emails regularly. And whether you've chosen to do it once a month or twice a month or once a week, whatever you decide to do, you need to like be fairly consistent and send out things that are actually interesting to people. And I just didn't have time to be like crafting newsletters and also writing novels. But this next year I decided, okay, I'm going to really make a push and try to build my mailing list. So I got into ActiveCampaign, which is much better than MailChimp. And I started doing a bunch of book funnel promotions and some on Prolific Works. And I built all of these automations. So there's a series of emails they get when they sign up. And I built ones for each series. So like if I got them in through Cowrie Catchers, it sends them a series of 5 emails that make sense coming in through Cowrie Catchers. If they came in through Incubus, it sends them a different series of emails. If they came in through Prophet, it sends them a different series. Hunters has one. Malachi has one. This took a lot of time to create. But I'm getting signups now at a rate of about 50 to 150 a day, which is a lot of people. It's a lot of people. And usually the robots handle it pretty well. Like the automation tells it mostly it runs itself, but every once in a while, like at the beginning, I accidentally sent out the wrong email to like hundreds of people, and then hundreds of people tried to write me at the same time. And there's definitely a problem with scale there where you just can't deal with this many people at the same time. But I've now got it up. I started with a list of about 600. That had been like that for years. And now it's up to like a little over, it's like 2,200. Like I crossed 2,000 at the beginning of the month. That's a lot of people. I've never had the list up that high before. This is a new effort for me. This is definitely higher tier stuff than I have done before. And so far, what I thought would work has worked. I can definitely get snowed under if I do something that causes them to all try to talk to me at the same time. And I can't be quite as personal with people because there's just too many of them. But it is working. And Book Funnel is free. Like, you don't really have to have – there's not a lot of expense bar to enter. So if you want to start giving away things through them and building your mailing list, I can tell you how.
Well, that, I'm overwhelmed just by the amount of what you described of having a different group of emails that go depending on what they are a fan of or what introduced them to you.
These are the things you can do to procrastinate actually writing your fiction.
Oh, boy. I don't need any of that. See, I come from a world where the internet exists.
Oh, good.
And yeah, the internet was created for porn and to prevent me from writing.
Okay.
Those are the two main things. I think tweeting.
And they're related, so... Go ahead.
But you still write a story for your Patreon supporters, right? And have them vote on... who the story will be about?
Yes, I try. So I stopped that for a while last year because I felt like the stories were sort of getting in the way of getting novels done.
Oh, okay, excellent. That's the question I was about to ask. So you answered it without, why did I interrupt you? Just let you talk.
Sorry, I will talk and talk. I stopped it for a while because I felt like the short stories were sort of getting in the way of novels and I was really clipping along on some novels at that point. But then what I should have done was start it back up again, because what I've realized is those stories do kind of prime the pump. they make me work on something even when I'm stuck, and I always feel like it's a little bit too much, but I think they are actually really good for me. So I started up again this year. Well, I did something different though. This year I said, okay, some of these stories are going really long, and I should just limit them to like 3,000 words or less. But I was having a hard time doing that, and some of my ideas for them were just bigger than a 3,000 or 5,000 or even a 6,000 word story. You know, they were novelettes and novellas. So I said, if the story goes over a short story, which is, I think, 7,500 words, if it's going to be longer than that, then I get 2 months. And if it's going to be, I don't know, longer than 14,000 words, I get 3 months. Like, you guys got to give me, like, I promise you a short story's length per month. But if you pick something and my idea for it is lengthier, then you got to give me a little more time. And I tossed this out to them and actually had them vote and said, hey, do you want me to write these longer, more involved stories, or would you really rather get something every single month, even if it's shorter? And they voted pretty conclusively that they were okay with the longer stuff. So this year I wrote a novelette in January and February. It's a Percy story. You'll narrate that eventually once it's all edited.
Oh no, and then your accent. Scottish.
It says POV, the whole story.
Oh no.
It'll be fine. It'll be lovely. I'll get the finished version and it'll sound great. Except you'll be yelling Scottish for all of the outtakes.
Oh boy.
And then they voted on Lucy, and I want to eventually do a novel about Lucy. And so I did this novella that was a setup for the novel, and I really got stuck on it, and it took me like 8 months to write, which is embarrassing. And I did finally finish it, and the beta readers seemed to like it, but it took me way longer to write than it should have, and definitely ran over all of my, I did not finish it in a timely fashion. I just had, you know, in my defense, I was moving across the country and buying a house and working full time, and I just couldn't, the creative muscle just did not work. But I did finish it, and people seemed to like what I finally finished. I was just abominably slow. So I don't know that I really succeeded this year. My goal was to write one every month, and I did write more than I would have written if I had not had that goal, but I didn't really succeed. Next year should be better. I already had them vote on a character, and they voted on Sue, which is, I think the last, that's Gwen's bat, his pet bat. I think that's the last Cowrycatcher's cast character that hasn't gotten a story yet. So I'm hoping to put that one out in January. Hopefully it won't take me 9 months or 8 months, or like, it was like having a child, this novella, Rich. It was like giving birth to a child. My God, so embarrassing. So see, that's terrible. I mean, you probably wrote a dozen stories in the time it took me to write that novella.
Sue
is the one where we do the voice like this,
right?
Yes.
Who is doing that story?
Probably Lauren. Okay. I mean, I could do that to your voice. I get an effect on your voice. Anybody can do
it. She really does a good job when she sends those lines. I don't know if it's just a lot more effort for me to do that voice than it is for her, but it just, there are certain voices that are hard. Marshall and I have a story where I wrote a story that's coming out on the Star Wars podcast that we did.
And one of the characters spoke like this through the whole thing.
And I lost my voice during the reading, and I had to quit for the night, not realizing that
doing this with your voice
will ruin your voice. That was just a lesson that I had to learn, I guess. But I ended up having to just go back and do only his lines and then splice them in, which of course took a lot longer. Anyhow, you said next year will be better. Is it because you're going back to part-time work?
Yes. The promised land of not working full-time in the operating room. Yeah, next year I'm going to work 2 days a week.
Oh, wow.
So we'll see if I like that. It's different than what I've done in the past. In the past, you know, I've done like weeks on, weeks off sort of thing, where I'll go somewhere and I'll work full time for several weeks, and then I'll come home and just be home for several weeks. And there's things about that that I enjoyed. I mostly enjoyed exploring the country, but it did require me to relearn good habits every single time my environment changed, right? So like all of your habit triggers that tell you it's time to write now, or it's time to exercise now, or now you have to go to the grocery store and buy food so you have something to eat. Like, all of those get disrupted every time you move to a different location like that. And so I think maybe having a schedule where I do more or less the same thing every week, I might be able to establish some of these habits and keep them instead of having to like reinvent the wheel every single time my environment changes. We'll see. I'm looking forward to trying it. It's possible that I won't like it, and then I'll go back to weeks on, weeks off sort of thing.
Let me suggest that you get a photograph of your father with a dour look on his face. And that you put it someplace where you go to write. And you train your brain to write whenever you go to this place. Otherwise, the picture of your father will judge you. Sorry, maybe that's not the best suggestion. Works for me, though.
Yeah, your dad and my dad, very different people.
So in the months when you haven't made your deadline of getting a story out to your Patreon supporters, do you hear about it? Do they let you know, hey, it's the 31st, we didn't get our story?
They're mostly extremely understanding, which is good and bad. I am probably my own worst critic in terms of feeling bad or making myself feel bad about not meeting deadlines.
Okay.
You know, sometimes they'll start to unsubscribe. They don't say anything. They just start to leave.
Oh,
and,
boy.
You know, that's a subtle hint. Maybe I should do something.
Well, hey, conversely, though, how much do you care whether people shower you with praise over something that you've written, especially if you liked it personally? You're just like, wow, this one turned out really well, and nobody says anything. How does that affect you?
It does a little bit. Like, I know it's bad. Like, I shouldn't care whether anybody says anything, but it does make me feel better if people say something. There are some people that comment pretty reliably on stories, but sometimes I will put something out and just, you know, nobody says anything. Kind of depending on how confident I feel about it. If I don't, you know, if I'm not quite as confident about it, that will make me wonder, like, well, maybe just nobody liked that. But then sometimes I'll hear from people months later and they'll be like, oh, I loved that. You know, I waited for it every day. And back in my head, I'm thinking, why didn't you say something?
Oh, boy.
I try to be constantly focused on the next thing that I'm excited about writing, you know, because you can't control whether other people respond or whether they like something or whether they tell you that they liked something, but you can control whether you like it, whether you're writing something that you actually enjoy writing. So I try really hard to be just excited about the next thing that I'm doing. And usually when I get too focused on, hey, nobody told me that they enjoyed that, it's usually a sign that I'm having a hard time coming up with what to work on next. And so instead of looking ahead, I'm looking back. If I can get my head in the right space where I'm really excited about what's coming next, then I will stop that.
Okay, well, let's move on to the big thing that I wanted to talk to you about. So, Abby, you write characters that are complicated, damaged a lot of the times, who have serious flaws in their personalities, or they have difficulties personally or socially. Where does that come from? Well, first of all, do you agree with that statement?
Yes, I do. Well, some of them have got a little bit of me in them, so there's definitely that. I mean, you get to know anybody well enough, and you'll find ways in which they are self-sabotaging and maybe their own worst enemy. Readers, in my experience, they tend to love characters for their flaws, not for their strengths. And this is something that my good friend Amy, we've had this conversation several times, where we'll talk about kind of the modern lefty. We tend to want to write character, like female characters and minority characters. We tend to want to write them strong with their shit together, right? We want to present them as people who are good, certainly not bigoted, and not a mess. But the problem with that is that Like, my most lovable characters are a mess. People love Silvio because he's so broken. And if you want people to love your girls and your minority characters as much as they love your boys, you've got to allow them to be as broken as your boys. And a lot of people resist that, especially when they're trying to be good and kind and fair to their women and their minority characters. And this is something I struggle with. I mean, we've had this conversation briefly before where I've said I usually identify with the guys in my stories. There's only a few of the girls in my stories that I really identify very strongly with, and that came later. Like, I had written many books before I wrote female characters I identified with at all, and that's my own problem. But I had to consciously tell myself that, like, let your girls be fucked up. People will love them for it. No one loves characters for their strengths. We love them for the ways they're broken. Was that an answer at all?
It is, and it sort of leads me to observe, let's say, that sometimes your characters will do something, I don't know, out of stubbornness that hurts them, or it's out of pique, or, I don't know, they just screw up, they slip. And I, as a reader, I wince. And I say, why? Oh, why did you do that? And sometimes the things that your characters do or say are self-destructive.
Yeah.
Is this something that you intend to happen, or these characters act on their own? If you know that Silvio has to go left by the end of the story, do you purposely have him go right, or does he just naturally go right?
Give me an example, because you know my work probably well enough to give me an example. What? Because I'm not quite envisioning what you're talking about.
I can't think of an example. I would try to write an open-ended question that encompassed everything, you know, where a character makes a mistake, or a character chooses the wrong, or a character has an addiction and they slip. I just...
Yeah. Well, there's also Go ahead. Sorry.
We don't want them to slip. We want them to be happy. We want them to make the choice that will lead to the happily ever after. But at the same time, we only care, right, when it's hard, when it's an uphill climb, when they slip and fall and pick themselves up. And I just think that that's really admirable that you're willing to do that with your characters, because sometimes, and don't take offense at this, but sometimes it's ugly.
Yeah, you may be a little bit in the minority for wanting them to be okay. I actually had some pushback in Jaeger Thunder, people basically saying that Silvio was boring now that he wasn't quite such a mess.
Huh.
That now that he had his life together a little bit more and was not, you know, disassociating and having nightmares all the time, that he was less interesting because I was kind of allowing him to pick himself up. But I don't know. For me, I think it's important to let characters who are going to recover actually recover. Like, I also don't think it's interesting to keep knocking people down in the same way over and over again. But at the same time, if they've got no problems to solve, the story is over. If they've got no personal growth to have, to me, then there's no story there. They need an arc. We've had this conversation before too, where sometimes you will write stories where the characters have, to me, no perceptible arc. And that is less compelling. It's, you're a good writer, and that will often draw me through the story, but it's really impossible for me to say what I would do if it wasn't your story, if it was somebody that I didn't know and hadn't read lots of their other stories, you know, and trusted them. But sometimes your characters do have, you know, arcs. I mean, in the Ben Park stories, you're talking about cringing. Every time he is powerless in the hands of adults, it makes me so uncomfortable. Like, I just want that part to be over. Like, it makes me so worried for him.
But that's a bad thing, right? I mean, because...
Yeah, no, but that's good. I mean, it's bad, but it's good, you know, because you have, like, your reader response and your writer response, and the writer in you is like, yes, yeah, good, I'm worried for this character, that is good writing, and then your reader response is, oh, no, I don't want this to happen.
Well, you know, I've been tempted a time or two to write a story that takes place in the 20th century when Ben is an adult, and can be an active protagonist and maybe like have his own adventure or maybe get his own sidekick. And I always push away from that. I love that I can go back to that well, and he's still 11 years old. He'll always be 11 years old. I don't know if that's sick, but I love the idea that I could write 10 of these and they all take place within a year or two, even though I'm an old man by the time I get to the 10th story.
What year is it?
Is 1896 the lean rider takes Ben from the orphanage. But I don't think I've ever spelled that out. I just, like, I'll have a reference to who is president or something like that. But yeah, I don't know that I've ever said, you know, New Year's 1897 had come and there were still drunks in the street.
Oh, so he's going to live through both of the world wars.
Oh boy, I hadn't thought of that.
Rich, she can have a flapper romance in the 20s, which is adorable.
I think he'd be over the hill by then.
It's never too late. Wait, how old will he be? In his 30s? Let's see. He's going to be, how old is he going to be at the turn of the century?
He'll be, what, 14 or 15 then, right?
Yeah. So yeah, he'd be in his 40s. He'd be your age in the 20s. And then he'll be too old to be in the army, but he will be alive unless he dies, you know, in the world wars, I think. Yeah, he'd be alive.
That's way, way too far in the future. If I live to be 100, maybe I'll consider something like that. But I just, I want to write these stories at the very end of the Old West. You know what I mean? Once the train got out here, it was over. The lawless West was over.
But see, that would be an interesting story too, about the train coming. Okay, so what we're doing right now with Benny, this is what happens when I write stories for my Patreon, because they'll vote on a character and it will force me to be like, okay, where were they on the time? If I'm going to write a story about a pivotal event in their life, like, where does that hit the timeline? And sometimes it will hit the timeline. I'll be like, oh, this is what was happening to this other character at the same time. I had no idea those two events lined up. Or, like, this is what's going to happen when this character is actually, like, coming of age. And I won't realize, like, that was actually where the timeline fell in the larger story setup, because I had no reason to roll it out, you know, and figure that out. And that always gives me ideas, you know, about stuff to do with them. But yeah, he could see the train coming, and it could be like a story about the death of the Old West.
It's funny that now we're talking about my stuff. I always revel in the fact that he's in over his head and he's naive and he's a child in a world run by adults. And he should be in school and should have parents and that, and he doesn't. And so, yeah, when you say that he has no, what was it that you said, that he has no control of his own life?
Yeah, it makes me worry for the character, which is good, you know, that's what you want. I mean, he's got a problem and he's not all that bright. So
no, none of my characters are all that bright. I don't know if you and I have had this conversation, but I've had it with Big Anklevich that I'm so tired of the genius child in a book. I don't want to read again about a kid that's in school, but he's smarter than his teacher ever again. I've just had it. I don't need it anymore. I've had my fill. And that was not my experience as a child. I understand that a lot of these writers are really smart people, but I'm still sometimes in a situation where I look around and I don't know what's going on. I don't feel smart. And then to have like an 11-year-old correcting the grammar of his English teacher, it just, ooh, yuck.
Well, even a smart kid has no life experience, and that's a significant disadvantage when dealing with adults. Did you read Neil Gaiman's Ocean at the End of the Lane?
I did.
That was a good book, and one of my favorite lines in it is, he talks about fairy tales and how in fairy tales, children beat monsters and they beat adults. But he says in real life, when adults and children fight, adults win. And having had some significant confrontations with adults as a child, that really resonated with me, because he's right. He's absolutely right. And yeah, and when you're in your stories, usually when adults and children fight, adults win. I'm not saying that. I mean, it's, you know, sometimes it's nice to have the fairy tale, but in real life, that is what happens.
Do you ever go too far with what happens to your characters? Your character is maimed. Your character is brutally beaten. Your character is humiliated. These are just the ones I've narrated for you. Do you ever go, oh gosh, maybe I need to pull that back? Or how do you go about this? How do you decide how far you can go in hurting a character or embarrassing them, in humbling a character? And do you ever regret that? Do you ever say, no, that was too far?
I usually worry more about pulling my punches, because I feel like, for the most part, your audience is more captured the more you hurt the character, unfortunately. Just in terms of storytelling, people tend to be more more interested in somebody with a worse problem. I was sorry that I killed Thessalan, mostly because I decided I could have written a more interesting story with the three of them. And that also had more to do with me just realizing that I had written a women refrigerators trope without meaning to, and not really knowing, you know, just copying patterns that I had seen before and not really understanding what I was doing. But I mean, also, my audience has heard this a million times. I mean, I had a different novel that never got published in which she had died, and I was trying very hard to end Cowrie Catchers in the right place to proceed into that novel, which I later scrapped. But I already knew where all the characters were going to end up at the end of the story, and I stuck to my outline on that part of the story. But other than that, no. I mean, if you give me an example, maybe I'll...
Well, we have characters with addictions, a poppy addiction. We have characters who are drunks. I don't know. Do you ever get audience feedback where they're just like, how could you do that to poor Silvio? He's my favorite character.
No, they love it.
They love it.
They love it. Especially if the character can overcome some of that in the course of their story. I mean, I don't think people really want to watch the character fall in the same hole over and over again. At least most of them don't. A few of them would be happy to watch the character fall in the same hole. But yeah, like, I mean, Silas is addicted to opium, and he will always be addicted to opium in the sense that in times of crisis or extreme stress, there's part of his brain that's always going to want to reach for that for comfort. But he has stopped using that drug, and as long as his life's not falling completely apart, he's unlikely to kill himself with it, which is where he was headed at the previous story. I think that's a believable addiction for a character like Silas. I like to write smart characters that are their own worst enemies. So I like writing smart people, but I know an awful lot of smart people that being smart doesn't always help them, isn't always enough to keep them from running themselves into the same hole over and over again. And yeah, I write those characters, although I hope that mostly they do get better. I mean, I don't write a lot of the kind of horror where everyone just dies at the end, so there's usually some kind of a hopeful arc to their stories.
Well, see, I really like Silas, and I mean, part of it is because I was there, not at the beginning, but, you know, the story that introduced him, I got to work on with you, right?
Yeah.
I got to voice Silas. I like him and I root for him. I want him to have a happy ending. I want him to succeed. I want, okay, this airship, you know, I don't, oh, he lost his air, you know.
Yeah.
I suffer when he suffers. But are you saying that is uncommon, that the rest of the readers love when he's suffering?
Oh,
they love to see him fall and lose because... It's all the more satisfying when he wins later or he gets back up?
Readers want to feel strong emotions. So yeah, I mean, they want to, I mean, it's a cliche, but they want to laugh and they want to cry. They'll tell you they threw the book against the wall, but then they'll buy all of your other books. No, I don't think it's because they actually they want the character to win. I mean, do you feel like you would like Silas just as much if he... completely had his shit together?
I don't know. I'm trying to see it from a writer's perspective, just to learn from what you have done with that character, because that's my experience as a fan, as a reader of that character, is Oh, come on. No, don't let her walk away. Suddenly I become vicariously involved in his life and I want him to best his enemies. I want him to get away. And you are willing to have him not get away. Or you are willing to have, if he only said the right thing, everything would be fine, but he doesn't say the right thing.
Well, thank you. That makes me happy. Partially because I've convinced you that I would let something really bad happen to them. Because it's hard. Like, if when you as a writer love a character a lot, it's easy to for the reader to get the impression that the character has... You've heard of plot armor before?
A character has plot armor?
Yeah, it's clear to the audience that the author would never kill or seriously harm the character. Like, it's clear to the audience that the author loves the character far too much for anything really bad to ever actually happen to them. And so, as a result, the audience feels the character's never in jeopardy. Even when bullets are raining around them, you're like, wow, well, not in danger. But see, I've convinced you they're in danger, so I'm glad you like the character. I'm glad you want him to succeed. I like that character, too. He actually, so I always ask people, or not always, but I do a lot of things where I'll tell people, you know, I'll answer you in a drawing or whatever, but just send me something telling me what your favorite character is. And it's funny to me because I get so many different answers to this question, like really a lot of different answers. And Silvio usually wins, but there's always a bunch of others that you wouldn't even necessarily expect. And this last time I did it, I thought Silas was going to beat him. He was beating him at the beginning, and then more votes came in, and then Silvio still obviously wins. But he was definitely the runner. Silas is definitely the runner-up. Also, I like S names too much. I have too many S names of favorite characters. See, I was going to ask you something. Can I ask you?
If you want, but I won't have a satisfying answer. I don't know why I do what I do. And so that's partly why I'm asking you as a storyteller why you know, a lot of the stuff that you're doing, and I think you're aware of it, is brave.
Well, thank you.
And maybe it's because I come from comic books, which are, you know, regardless of what my generation says, it was escapist fantasy for little boys. That's what comic books were intended to be. The target audience was children. And so it is really rare for the bad guy to win, or even to get away, or even for there to be a stalemate in the way I was raised in that kind of literature, if you can call it literature. And so just the going into grown-up books, I'm just amazed that you can get that kind of stuff where, you know, not only does the hero not win, but he loses badly. It's like I showed up in the middle of the game and it was like, wait, you can do that? You can do that in this sport? So.
Well, I thank you. Because again, I feel like the thing that I worry about far more than hurting them too much is pulling my punches. That's the thing I always ask myself. Am I pulling my punches? I'll say that I regret killing Thess, but then I'll be like, well, are you never going to do that again? Don't you need to kill another major character? Although I feel like if you kill a major character too often, that becomes a cliche too. Like, you can't return to that well over and over. I feel like that was the mistake The Walking Dead made. So I was really invested in that series beginning. I read the comics, but they were a one-trick pony, and they did a lot of, like, I shouldn't say that. They did other things, but when they wanted to shock and get our attention, they did it by killing major characters. And some of these characters had escaped from horrible things victoriously in previous episodes. And so it was like all of their victorious escapes were undermined by then later, from their point of view, months later, having them brutally murdered. You know, it didn't work anymore. And I feel like I've gotten to the point in the Coward Catchers Refugees books where if I kill any of the major characters, I will undermine their previous victories and it will be unsatisfying. But at the same time, I do want people to feel like characters are really in danger. So at the end of Albatross, I knew I needed to kill someone. I knew that book in the finale, somebody needed to die. I didn't want to kill any of the characters, and I thought about it a lot, and I finally realized that what I could do was kill the airship. And it would have the same emotional impact, but it would not be one of the characters. So that's what I did.
Well, that's smart. Let me ask you about the last story in Before the Wind. And maybe it's not the last story, but it's the one that takes place after Jaeger Thunder. It was your coda.
Okay. So Silas one or Felbin?
Yeah, Silas and Percy have this connection.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really, really hard for me to narrate. It was really hard for me to read when you sent it to me, because I want Silas and Anaru to live happily ever after. And I was worried that this will come back to ruin, to destroy his relationship with Anaru. And I don't know, because she's fine with it. She comes from a different culture, right? Mm-hmm. With sexual mores that are totally different. But was that a... should I not have worried about that? Is that something that you had intended in that story?
I address it in that story because I did want to diffuse that concern. And I feel like... I don't know, I like writing polyamorous relationships. They pop up in my stories a lot. Anaru is an active participant in restoring Silas and Percy's friendship to begin with. Like, she's the one that brings Percy up to the honey tail when Silas is working on it, and brings that picture of the night that he won the albatross, and kind of forces them to initiate the conversation where they actually discuss what happened, and Silas apologizes, which he should have done on his own, but he doesn't. And so I've already, Anaru isn't a dummy. So I feel like I tried to diffuse that concern by making it obvious that she was already part of this to some extent. And then, you know, they do have a conversation about that in the moment where Percy is like, oh, I know why you don't want to do this, and you're happy, et cetera, et cetera. And Silas just laughs. And he's like, Anaru is not why. It's just you. It's not her. But yeah, I don't know. It really depends on where a person's, probably somebody's personal background, how concerned they feel by that element in that story. But I don't know. I feel like I did what I could to address it, because I didn't want that concern to be something that was hanging over the reader's head while they were reading that story. And I don't know, have you read my opening chapter of The Cormorant? I posted it a while back. I don't know if you read it. You're probably waiting to read it until...
I haven't. Is Cormorant ready to go? Is it done?
Oh, no, it's not done. But I posted the first couple chapters on my blog, I don't know, a few months ago. So Anaru comes from a culture where women often have multiple male mates, and where men do a lot of childcare. So in those opening chapters, I mentioned that Percy is very involved with the baby, Amma. She doesn't sleep at first because she's tiny. She's born like a Panon, even though she, because the Fawns have much more developed babies that kind of look like human babies. But the Panons have these tiny little babies that don't have their eyes open. They can't hear. They're like, you know, they're like kittens. And that's how Amma is born. So Anaru just finds her very alien. She's not at all like a Fawn baby. Anaru doesn't really know what to do with her. It's basically like there's a fourth trimester after the baby is born. She comes way early. She doesn't have any milk for her because basically Anaru's body thinks she miscarried. But that's just how baby Panons are born. They're born very premature and early. And so this child needs a lot of care. Usually these kids are born in like litters of two or three. She's all by herself. So basically somebody has to be touching her all the time or she doesn't sleep. And so this is a kind of exhausting job. And Percy steps up and does a lot of that. Like he paces all night, holds her all night, paces around the ship with her all night. So there's a scene where Marley, Glossy, and Gus are speculating as to what this behavior means and whether like Percy's just trying to ingratiate himself to Anaru because he wants Silas. And I think it's Glossy. Yeah, because Glossy's the midwife. And she's like, I don't know. She's like, I had a conversation with her where Anaru's just like, well, of course Percy wants to do that. Males have very powerful paternal instincts. You can't. This is Anaru's culture that she comes from, right? In her culture, women, the work that they do is having the baby. That is a big job. And once they've done it, they pass it off to the men so that their strong paternal instincts can take over and they can do the actual childcare that, you know, really isn't women's work. So Anaru is just, if this is an attempt to ingratiate himself, she's just oblivious because she just thinks this is what men do. Like, they can't help it. Men cannot look away from babies. They just have to pick one up when they see it. They just provide care. That's their male instinct. This is Anaru's line of thinking. Anyway, because I do this gender flip, you know, with the Zeds. Anyway, that's in those opening chapters of the
program. Okay, I just went to your website and I see it there. I will read that.
You don't have to. I'm sure you'll read it eventually in a more edited version, but you might enjoy it for some of those reasons.
Is there a timeline on that? Have you set a goal for yourself on Cormorant?
I hope I will finish it next year. We'll see.
Well, you're only working 2 days a week, so.
I know. I've got this, there's a werewolf Christmas romance that I'm writing.
I'm sorry, you cut out for a second. It sounded like you said werewolf Christmas romance. What did you really say?
All those words did come out of my mouth. I'm sure it will have a different final title. I outlined the first few chapters of this last year and then hit a difficult place and gave up like a pansy. And so this year I'm determined to actually get it finished. I don't know. It's fun. It's a werewolf Christmas romance. And then I have to write the Sue story. And then I believe, unless something else strange happens, that I will work on Cormorant and hopefully finish it and the book that comes after it.
Well, maybe I should leave you to that because I'm curious about a werewolf Christmas romance. Is it male, female?
It is. It's a heterosexual romance.
And which is the werewolf?
The guy.
Well, maybe I need to put my name in the hat for narrator on that, too.
You could. It's got shifting POVs, so...
Oh, no, not that.
It's not all... But, well, I think probably one person needs to narrate it. The shifting POVs thing is hard. You and Lauren do it quite well, but I think... I would never choose to do that, except that I think that since we were coming from a full cast, it was the best compromise, you know, with the full cast. But having different people voice the same characters is, I think, quite strange. You know what I mean?
Huh.
That was a no. You're like, I have no idea what you're talking about.
No, it makes me think about it. Every once in a while, I also am tempted to do another full cast production. And usually I am able to convince myself not to do it.
Right? Because, I mean, it's been a while since you stabbed yourself in the eyeball. It's been some time. So you've forgotten how much it hurts and you could do it again.
I guess I can see if you have fans that don't like your later work because it's not full cast. They don't like it as much.
But you know what? They still buy it. So
they still buy it. So F them.
And I also hear from people that don't like the full cast. There's definitely people that leave crappy reviews on Cowrie Catchers going, I was just very amateurish, all these different voices, I just couldn't get used to it. Well, F you.
We had a 1-star review on Apple. What's Apple's website? iTunes.
Oh, I don't remember. There you go. Mm-hmm.
And it was, these guys say that it's a podcast, but all the stories they do are audio drama with multiple voices. Do not listen.
Oh.
And I remember telling Big at the time, had I known that somebody would be upset by this, I wouldn't have done all the extra work that it takes doing full cast.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Sir, where were you when we first started the podcast?
Exactly.
We'd have so many more episodes.
Yeah. You would never have put in that 10 times as much work. You had known that asshole would hate it. I don't know. I think about sometimes doing it just for a story, mostly to amuse my Patreon. I don't know. Then I'm like, well, will that set a precedent? Because I don't want to do this all the time. I mean, that's why I did it for Cowrie Catchers. And I'm like, okay, the more I do this, the more people are going to get used to it. We got to cut this tooth out now. The next book, not going to be forecast because this is a labor of love. It's a one-time thing for this project. Not going to set a precedent going forward because I can't keep it up. But I thought about having them like vote on a story. Like, hey, here's all my stories. Would you like me to do one of these as a full cast production?
Hmm. Yeah, see, I made that sound again. That non-committal sound. I don't know. I ran a story really recently and I assume you listened to it because you paid for it, whether you did or not.
It's true.
Which had run over on Cast of Wonders as a full cast, and I ran my solo read on the Rish Outcast. And as you know, Bob, I didn't want to run it. I didn't know if it was okay to run it because the full cast was totally fine, but the writer wondered when it was coming out. Anyway, I finally did run it, and he wrote me a nice email after the writer, and he for one was glad that I had run my solo read on it, but I still didn't feel like that it should have existed, that my version should have existed. despite all the problems that I had with the full cast version. And I think about the people that edited that full cast version and how much more work it was for them when they could have just ran what I did. I don't know. It's funny that you say that you'll let them choose, because of course they're going to say full cast.
Oh, I meant say, okay, I've decided to do one story for you guys as full cast. Pick which story.
Okay, but they're going to pick the one that has the most characters so that it'll have the most variety, and that equals the most amount of work for you.
Possibly. So going back to what you just said, why did you feel like you shouldn't have released yours?
Well, it just felt self-indulgent. It felt like someone somewhere would say, Rish thinks that his solo read was better than the full cast production.
You know, that's just...
Which it was.
That's the portrait of your father talking.
Wait, which part? The portrait of my father was not the which it was part.
The part where it is self-indulgence really is your version of the story. That's the portrait of your dad talking.
Okay. But I did fear that they would say that, and that maybe I would never get work from Cast of Wonders again.
Well, that's maybe legitimate, although they're not listening to your Patreon. They're not. They don't care what you do on your Patreon.
Okay.
Anyway, I enjoyed listening to it, and I would have never heard it otherwise because I'm not subscribed to Cast of Wonders. I do think that full cast and solo reads are more different formats than better. And if they were the same amount of work, then it would just be a matter of taste, right? I like this one. I like that one. The problem is that full cast is literally 10 times as much work. And it's not 10 times better. I mean, even if you do like it better, at most it's twice better, you know? And it's not twice as much work. It's more than twice. I mean, maybe if you're really good, it's only four times as much work.
Okay, but what you do with me and Lauren, that feels like the best of both worlds.
That works pretty well.
You get a female narrator for the female characters, a male narrator for the male characters, and that's all you need.
Well, I mean, okay, so what people would like best in that case would be for me to actually splice you guys together so that every time a female character is talking, it's Lauren's voice, and every time a male character is talking, it's your voice, and I pick one of you as the narrator. That would be the ultimate way to do that, and I do think it would work. You know, it wouldn't be as much work as full cast, but it would be considerably more work than what I do. The problem with what I do is that you have a version of Gus, and Lauren has a version of Gus, and you guys are both very talented mimics, so those versions are similar enough that they're recognizable. But there's still something jarring for people about hearing two different people voice the same character. And this is not a problem in full cast. You know, this is not an issue at all in full cast because the same person voices the character every single time we hear them.
Except for unique. In episode 7, when that guy that did the voice in episode 1 doesn't show up again and you need somebody to replace him. Maybe you suggest to your Patreon people to pick a story where you do have both me and Lauren narrate it and you splice the voices together. It's still twice as much work as just doing a regular audiobook or an audio story, but just to see how that might sound or feel.
That's true. I do think it would sound good. I think for most people it would work better than what I'm doing just because, you know, they would hear the character in exactly the same voice every time. That might be worth... Might worth a try. I do that with the Christmas werewolf story.
It's just a story. It's not a novel.
It's going to be a short novel unless I lose all control of myself and make it a long novel, but I really hope not. It's a standalone, hopefully a standalone urban fantasy, I guess.
Christmas werewolf romance.
Yes.
You picked three words out of a hat and were forced to write a story about them.
Yeah, it was one of the old Din Steve challenges. You've forgotten about it, but yeah. I know, it's a horrible name. It needs a real name.
You put it right out there. Nobody is going to be confused with a title like that.
It's true.
A Very Werewolf Christmas.
I thought about calling it Coy Wolf Christmas because, you know, coy is cute and sounds romancy. And that actually sounds like a title. But that was when I was actually having him be a coy wolf, which a coy wolf is a real thing. It's a coyote wolf hybrid. And I haven't decided whether I will actually have him be a coyote wolf hybrid. He's looking more like just a regular wolf, so then it doesn't make sense. Anyway, it needs a better title. It does. Although, if it doesn't get one, I guess I will just publish it as Werewolf Christmas Romance.
Well, that's going to be next Christmas, you think?
Probably.
But yes, let's get together again and talk about Werewolf Koi Halloween sometime. Yeah, that sells itself. I really want to read that.
Thank you. I was not expecting that response. I was expecting you are going to pick a real title, right?
Oh, well, yes, I hope you pick a real title, but you can have a Werewolf Christmas Romance as the subtitle.
So can I ask you, do I get to ask you questions?
If you want, I was trying to wrap it up.
Okay. You set goals for yourself. Do you usually hit those goals? And when you do, are you tempted to raise the bar every time?
No, I'm not like that at all. Big Anklevich has the, you know, I'm going to write 500 words each day. And when I finish this month, I'm going to write 1,000 words next month. And I think I'm a little more pragmatic than that. If I manage to write 500 words every day this month, then that's a huge accomplishment. And I'm not going to set myself up to fail next month. I tend to set like 3 goals for a month and I never achieve all of them. But instead of getting down on myself for the ones that I didn't, I try to focus on the ones that I did and just carry over the other goals for next month.
Well, that is admirable. That sounds like a smart and well-balanced way to set goals. You set them for the month, not daily goals, monthly goals.
Right. I wonder if I should try to do what he does. He texts me every single day how many words he wrote. Although it's more like twice a week he texts me to tell me how many words he wrote. But that's part of his goal is, you know, he has somebody that's going to hold him accountable for the thing that he said he was going to do. And I try and call him every day and say, hey, I'm just calling to remind you to write. But I wonder if I did that, if I said, okay, January 1st, I'll let you know how many words I wrote. January 2nd, 3rd, 4th, we'll go through the whole month. Because it feels really good at the end of the month to see how many words you accomplished, how many, all of those together. And because I don't write in my notebook anymore, I use the laptop, it's so easy to just say, okay, there you go, 450 words, 1,250 words.
That sounds very smart. I have a problem with moving goals upwards, not quite like big. Big sets insane goals that seem unrealistic. But what I will do is kind of inch them. It's like a drug, right? Like once you're getting the same amount every month, then that's not impressive anymore. So you try to you have to get more of it to have the same feeling, if that makes any sense. So dopamine reward centers in your brain. And I sometimes struggle with this idea of like outsmarting yourself. So if I aim for 3,000 words a day, there's a real good chance that I'll write more than 1,000. I'll write 3,000 some days, but on other days I'll write 12 or 15. And that's better than 1,000, right? But I won't feel good. Like I'll feel bad because my goal was 3, you know? I'll go around feeling bad. If I set it for 1,000, which has been my goal most of my writing life, I can hit that fairly reliably and then I will feel good. You know, because I did the thing that I was trying to do. But if I set those more unreasonable goals, I accomplish more, but I go around feeling bad.
Oh.
And I often wonder if it's worth that.
Which is better, that you wrote 50,000 words but feel bad, or you wrote 30,000 words and feel good?
Yeah, exactly. There's no answer. I just wonder if other people play these games with themselves.
Well, I know a guy who writes 10,000 words every hour, and if there is a bridge that's collapsing, he'll be there. No, I hold him up over and over and over again because I eventually realized that you can't compare yourself to Brandon Sanderson because you're always going to fail. I can just compare myself to peak me, to the best that I, the most productive that I was, and if I'm nearing that or as productive as I can be, then that's success. I don't know. I mean, Big had set this this goal of being a professional writer by the time he reached a certain age. And that's crazy, because you can't determine whether you're going to be a professional writer or not. There are fans, there are buyers, there are publishers. There are all these factors that will make you succeed or make you fail.
That are not in your control, yes.
Right, and I just...
You got to set goals that are within your control. That's just a basic rule of productivity. Like, you can't make goals based on what other people will do. Like, I can't make... People ask me all the time, like, when's your next audiobook coming out? And I'm like, it really depends on how fast Rish and Lauren work. Because I can't control sometimes when things get to me. Yeah, also I got to actually, you know, once I hand you guys the book, and that's not a knock on you guys. Audio is... I can't control how fast other people work, so... Yeah, that doesn't sound like a realistic goal to me, although, but maybe Big feels like if he sets these, like, hit the moon kind of goals, he will still accomplish more. It would just make me feel really bad, because I like to hit my goals.
Sure. Yeah. And everybody is different, of course. You know, it's like, I'm going to hit myself with this belt 10 times if I don't accomplish my goal. That's somebody's motivation. Or somebody who's like, I'm going to eat this donut tonight if I achieve my goal. I mean, I guess they both achieve the same end, but they're very, very different. And one would work for one person and one doesn't. And oh my gosh, I love donuts. But
it's true.
I don't know. I like to talk to people about their process and about how they manage to do things and all that, because it's been a while since I surrounded myself with creative people. Remember when we used to go to the New Media Expo, and we'd be in a room with a bunch of people, and they're all creative. They're all either writers or podcasters or voice actors or...
Yeah, we should pick a conference and get everybody to go again.
And that was just great to be around these other people. Some of them are making it happen. Some of them are less successful than me, and that makes me feel like I need to mentor them, or I can just lay back and feel good. It was neat. And so that's, you know, I've been bugging you to sit down and talk to you about your mindset, your writing for all these months. And then, you know, finally I've done it. It's a long episode, but I really appreciate that you set aside 2 hours of your life to hang out with me. I guess it's only been an hour and a half. Oh, 2 hours.
I like talking about writing stuff. I also enjoy that. I was going to ask you, when is the next Laura and the Witch book? Because as we know, that's my favorite of your many properties.
The second book is written, and I wrote it last year in 2018. And it's long. I don't know that it's a novel, but I had 3 or 4 finished pieces. I had the sequel to The Calling. I had something called My Friend of Misery, which is about a little boy who befriends something very, very evil. And then I had the second Laura and the Witch book, and I chose to produce The Calling because it's the longest ago. I wrote it in 2017, and it is huge for me. I mean, it's nothing compared to one of your books, but it qualifies as a novel, and that really surprised me because I'm not a novelist. I'm a short story guy. So as soon as I'm done with that, it's a slow process. I'm only on chapter 7 right now. Then I guess I'll set a goal for what the next project will be. I try to do a big project, which is usually for a novella. And then, you know, I'll do like a short story, which I can run on the show. So it's like double duty. I sit down and I record this story. I can put that out there or in a collection.
Okay.
And then I will... Well, the thing with the novellas is I can't run them on the show because they're too long.
I play out episodes of book-length things all the time.
Really?
Yeah. Just read it in, you know, installments.
And people don't get upset about that? They don't come...
Yeah. At least they don't not love it. They've never told me they do not love it.
Okay. Well, I will consider that, I suppose.
In fact, the way I'm doing it now, let's see, the people at the $3 level get my professional audio when I'm producing it before it goes up on Audible. But the people at the $5 level get my solo reads of stuff, particularly stuff that I wrote for the Patreon. So that was another thing that I changed when I switched everything up at the beginning of the year, when I said, okay, the short story is going to come back. But I wasn't charging enough for them Frankly, I was releasing the text at the $1 level and the audio at the $3 level, and for stuff that I was writing specifically for the Patreon, that really wasn't enough, especially since those short stories, they don't sell like novels, and I basically, what I'm getting paid by the Patreon is pretty much what I'm going to get paid for them. So I moved all that stuff to the $5 level. So yeah, I read stuff to them at the $5 level, and some of it is way longer than an episode. Some of it is in installments. Yeah, nobody complains. They'll be just as happy.
Oh shoot, I'm out of recording space.
Oh no, sorry. I'm sorry. Why do you think you have to read it all in one episode?
I don't. I just, you know, I've had a 2-hour episode before, and I think, wow, that's super long. But yeah, I wonder if people resent me when I break up a story into two halves.
No.
And all that stuff. And I never hear any criticism about it, but maybe it's that picture on my wall.
Yeah.
Saying, you know, that could have been one episode and you spread it over two. I don't know. But yeah, the second Laura and the Witch is done. And yeah, if you bug me about it, maybe I'll make that a priority in 2020 to put that out.
I can definitely bug you about it. I never know when I'm bugging you too much. Do I need to stop sending you tickets to London? Is that terribly irritating?
It's not irritating, but just to me, it's pie in the sky. I how you said you had to pay off your student loans before you could even think about just being a writer. You know, I have so much money that I owe that I'm trying to manage that. And maybe I'll never be on top of that, but we'll see.
I'm sorry. I know at one point you dug yourself out of some credit card debt,
You dug me out of credit card debt that one time with what was the first book that I did for you? The 150,000.
That was Hunters. That was Hunters
Unlucky. Yeah, that came at a really good time.
I just need to write Cormorant. You know, The Knight and the Necromancer might get you out of credit card debt. I don't know whether you're the right narrator for that book or not. And I feel bad even talking to you about it because I feel like it hurts your feelings if I say you're not. Does it hurt your feelings?
Well, I am sensitive about that. But I recognize that my voice isn't perfect for everything.
Here's the thing, and you can tell me whether this is even... You tell me what to think about this. So I kind of had you do the Silas and Percy story because I wanted to see how you did MM stories. Male. MM is shorthand in romance for gay.
Male.
Yeah. And what I heard, and I batted a few lines back to you. What I heard you do in that story was, okay, so you act all of your lines. When the character has been running, you are out of breath. When the character is crying, you have tears in your voice. When the character is fucking, you don't sound like somebody who is turned on. And if you've heard, Incubus, you know Lauren acts those scenes, man. She sounds like she is getting off, and it sounds good. It sounds really good. People like it. So I need you to actually act those scenes if I'm going to give you these kinds of books. Now, The Knight and the Necromancer is not as sex-drenched as Incubus. It is more of a romance than an... So Incubus was kind of... It tread the line of erotica, especially for that first book, and then it gets more romancy in the second and third books. But I was always like, okay, we've been two chapters, there's been no sex scene, I got to come up with something. Like, I really, like, made myself come up with a sex scene, like, every few chapters. And The Knight and the Necromancer, I just let myself write the story. So it's got quite a bit of just epic fantasy. It's got a lot of plot to it. It's got quite a few characters to it. There are, I think, 3 major sex scenes in 150,000 words. So it's more like Calorie Catchers in terms of like ratio of sex to plot. And I know you can do it. I know you've got the chops for it, but I don't know if it embarrasses you to really act out those scenes or if it like hurts you in your soul. Because I know for me, so when I started writing the sexier books, it was amazing how well they sold. Like I was amazed. Like they really do sell so much easier than epic fantasy. But one thing that I figured out for me is if I write sexy stories that I am not enjoying, I feel like I'm doing sex work. Like if I'm like, I'm going to write a scene that I don't actually enjoy just because other people enjoy it, then I feel bad. Like I feel like I'm actually doing sex work and I don't like it. Like I know I have nothing but respect for sex workers, but I don't want to be one. Right. So,
okay. I think you and I are on the same page there, because when I was really hungry, I did some smut, under a pseudonym out there, hoping that would sell well enough. But I felt it the whole time. I felt like I was compromising who I was
.
And it didn't occur to me that you would be able to tell in my performance. But maybe, yeah, maybe those stings. But I don't know. Like when I do Percy's voice, can you tell that I'm really, I have a hard time with that accent? I don't know if that is the same sort of thing.
You have very authentic emotion in your voice through most scenes, but you're somewhat wooden on the sex scenes. And I don't know if that's because if you're uncomfortable or if you're just afraid that if you act too much, the people will like think poorly of you, or if you just don't want to act those scenes. And it's okay if you don't, but then you're just not quite the right person for that book. And that's why I was kind of like, well, maybe I should send in the first few chapters and you kind of like see what the story is about. But I don't know, you know, and also I don't want to send you something when you need money and you to feel like, well, I have to say yes, you know, because I need to get paid for this.
Okay, well, yeah, I probably am not the best fit then, just like your instinct told you.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, if you can tell that it's not my forte or it's not something I'm really good at or strong with, then yeah, I guess that answers that question.
Yeah, I don't want to pressure you to do stuff that you don't enjoy or scenes that you don't enjoy or that you, yeah, you go from acting to kind of reading in those scenes where you're just not quite, you know, into it. So anyway, I don't hope it didn't hurt your feelings.
No, it was something that I wasn't aware of, but it does make me wonder about other projects like that.
And I'm sure you could, like I said, I wasn't sure if it was because you hadn't, I don't know.
It's okay. The sex worker parallel is really apt, actually.
Yeah, because like,
that's how I felt when I was doing the, the adults only Audible projects.
Yeah. And if it had been erotica that you really liked and that you were enjoying, you might not have felt that way about it. But I'm guessing it was not stuff that you were enjoying. Because like when I write it, like I have to, even if scenes in my books are not anything that I would do in real life, it needs to be something that I do find enjoyable, that I would find enjoyable to read, you know, if somebody, because if it's not, if it's something that I'm just doing for someone else's, you know, to turn on someone else, then to me, that does feel like, it feels like I'm doing sex work and I don't like it. So if you've done stuff that you would have read anyway, then maybe you didn't feel that way about it. I don't know. Have you actually done any sexy stories that you personally thought would have been enjoyable if you'd been listening to them?
Yeah, there have been a couple that were well written, and you know, the relationships weren't just about bodily fluids. Mm-hmm. Then but most of the ones that I did, you could tell they just pumped them out, no pun intended, because they sell, and you know, we're writing these as fast as they could, and that they were cookie cutter. And
yeah, and just, so that would make me feel there's lots of other ways to make a living, you know, and I really don't want to write anything just because it sells. I really would like to be enjoying anything I'm writing, but that kind of thing particularly, I'd rather be in the operating room, frankly, than writing sexy stories that I don't enjoy writing. And I think you'd probably rather be doing something else than narrating stories that you don't enjoy.
Okay, I think I'm going to wrap it up again.
Okay.
That's cool.
That last part, cut that out.
Which part? The whole thing about the...
I think so. What? Do you want to leave that in there?
Well, I don't know. That might be really interesting for listeners, but yeah, we can chop that. No problem.
It might be really... Yeah, the things that listeners like most are the things that I least want to tell them. I don't know. When you edit it, you can see whether you think that it should be left in there and then send it to me before you post it so I can. Because I was really just talking to you, although I didn't turn off my recorder, so.
Okay, yeah, don't worry about it. I can lift that part and send it to you if you want it. But hey, look, again, thank you for hanging out with me and sharing your time and your insights. I need it. I appreciate it.
You are welcome. It is fun. And yeah, hope you publish the next Laura and the Witch soon. And my listeners that are listening to this, if they want to understand some of the stuff we're talking about, should go subscribe to Rich's podcast.
Well, I agree. So thank you. I hope you have a great 2020. 2020 is like when you have perfect vision, right?
Yeah, that's going
to
happen.
Am I the first person to realize that? That this new year is the...
Probably.
Is shorthand for good vision?
I don't think you are, in fact. Isn't there a whole Facebook meme about that? I don't know. Yes, you're the first person, the very first person. I was going to say, don't listen to the portrait of your father. And good luck with wrapping everything up and whatever it is you do that is very busy at the end of the year. I know you have, there's something that you do, there's some job that...
It's sex work. I won't make any bones about it, depending on your interpretation of that phrase. Thank you. Once again, this is Abby Hilton, and the website is abigailhilton.com.
That is correct.
Is it World or Worlds of Abigail Hilton?
I call the podcast the Worlds of Abigail Hilton podcast, just because I have more than one writing universe. But that's only on Patreon now. And yeah, you can sometimes hear Rich narrate various stories on my Patreon. I put the professional audio out before it goes up on Audible, and then I take it down when it's exclusive to Audible. And I have a podcast there every week on my website that I just try to prattle on about whatever I'm doing.
I'm sorry, every week?
Yes.
Holy cow. See, now I wish
Sometimes I miss a week. I've thought before, Rish only does this once a month. Why am I bothering to do this every week? So I broke down a while back, and well, actually it was when I went to Taiwan. I did a daily thing for them when I was in Taiwan, just a few minutes, you know, at a time. But I'd talk about what I was doing, and I'd post pictures of fun, weird, foreign things in Asia. And I fixed it on my phone so I could record into my phone's recorder, and then I could record into MP3, and then I just posted it. I told myself I did not get to edit. Whatever was on there was on there. And I did not, no intro, no outro, just posted it. And you know what? Nobody complained. So ever since I came back, I've just been recording them that way. Because it takes twice as long to record with the Zoom and then put it in the computer. And then I just can't help myself. I do a little bit of light editing when I do that. I can't help it. And then I have to put an intro on it and an outro on it and do all the uploading. And so now I just record it on my phone's recorder. I stick it straight up, and nobody has complained. Nobody. So, yeah, there are faster ways if you can bear to not edit it.
Well, maybe I should consider that. Like Big and I years ago did daily podcasts as like a fundraiser kind of thing. And I wonder if I could do like a daily thing, like choose the shortest month, February, and do something like that. But it does amaze me that you've got weekly podcasts. Impressive.
It's just me talking. Unless I've got something to put out. Like if I do have an audiobook that I'm putting out, then that will be, you know, the weekly podcast, and I won't trouble myself to speak every week. And sometimes I do miss weeks. Like every once in a while I'll just get busy and miss a week. But I figure they're getting plenty of me talking that they can suffer the occasional missed week.
Well, I will keep that in mind.
But anyway, yes, speaking directly into your phone and then just hitting upload greatly expedites the process of doing weekly podcasts. All right, I know it's been a long time. All those children probably want you to feed them or something, or throw balls to them, or I don't know.
Raw meat works. Sometimes we'll go to the pet store, but raw meat was always. I thank you again. I have been Rish Outfield.
And I am Abigail Hilton.
And good night.
All right.
Now listen up, you, because I shan't be saying this again. Like it or not, the Rish Outcast is presented under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share Alike license. While it hurts to say, that means you can't alter, sell, or claim ownership of the file. But you can download it, share it, and grind it to bits under your heavy boots, free of charge. There's also a Patreon fund attached to it, if you've lost hold of your senses and want to encourage more of the show. You can donate $1 an episode and up, or just contribute monthly to Outfield's daft schemes. Thus endeth the lesson.
Sorry, I've got a helicopter outside the window.
I can barely hear it.
Oh, well, see, there's a train that goes past the house every night at like 11:30, and I only hear it when I'm recording because I'm just used to it now. But I'm always so paranoid that it shows up on the recordings.